Thank you very much for this introduction, and thank you all for coming. I know it's the last program, and after a three-day tiring conference, so we utmost appreciate everybody who's come to listen to our discussion. I'm the director of CAS Media Africa, which is the sub-Saharan media program of the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, and we are based in Johannesburg, and we do many programs, and amongst them, we do a lot of programs with bloggers. We have a network called Africa Blogging. And in this network, Anglophone and Francophone bloggers in Africa exchange their views, their opinions. They also create a network and an exchange across cultural and language barriers, which, as you might be aware of, are very, very high, even in Africa, 50 years after decolonization. So when we talk about blogging in Africa, or we talk about the digital world in Africa, we have seen this afternoon a very interesting film by Géraldine Debastien about digital Africa, that is mostly commercial digitalization. But when we talk about media and digital activities in Africa, it becomes very, very sensitive, because Africa, as you know, is a diverse continent with many, many differences. And even in the digital world, you have a lot of differences between different countries. You have different download speeds, you have different laws, you have different extents to which freedom of expression is guaranteed in these countries. And particularly so for bloggers, the situation is ever-changing, and we're going to talk with three of our guests that we have invited from the continent now in the next hour about their lives and their work as bloggers on the African continent, about the need to exchange, and that they don't understand themselves as part of the digitally disadvantaged South, as you might hear it in the developed North from time to time. Let's welcome on the stage today three of our bloggers from Africa Blogging. They are Aisha Dabo from The Gambia, and Takura Zangaza from Zimbabwe. And finally, Anne-Marie Buffon from Cameroon, who's living in Senegal. I think to give a brief introduction to our audience, Aisha, would you like just to briefly describe who you are, what you're doing? At the background, we have some screenshots running throughout the program that give you a little bit of an impression. And Aisha.
Thank you, Christophe. I am Aisha Dabo. I am a Gambian and a Senegalese. I am based in Dakar, and I consider myself as an active citizen and a blogger. I am a trained journalist, and I've worked extensively on Africa, in the continent, and everything that has to do with Africa for a number of years.
You were very essential and very crucial in, shall I say, the developments in your native home country, the Gambia, when it came to the flight of the then dictator Yahya Jammeh.
Yeah, Jammeh came to power in 1994, and I think two-thirds of my life actually I've been under this dictator, who every year, every action, he just took it a notch higher when it comes to human rights violations, when it comes to executions, when it came to torturing people. And journalists were the most who suffered actually under Jammeh. It extended to other parts of society, but those who were trying to find out what were really happening in the country and giving the information were the main target. And unfortunately, one of our veteran journalists was assassinated in 2004, and the media house I was working for was attacked twice. A radio station was burned down, so it was a very, very difficult situation to work in. And it's with that when I moved in Senegal, I continued sharing about the Gambia, talking about the Gambia, wherever I think this is the second international platform I am at, and I'm not talking about human rights abuses in the Gambia. So it my whole life, actually, wherever I went, I talked about what was happening at home, what needs to be done. And with everyone, all hands on deck, I mean, there was an election in December 2016 and Jammeh was voted out.
We are going to talk later on more in depth about the means or about the use of blogging and of social media when it comes to political upheavals in Africa, because that's, as we all know, a very, very sensitive situation for the societies, for the powers that be, and for opposition forces as well. Takura Sangaza, you have experienced a situation which is comparable with the situation in the Gambia only 6 months ago, when the president and dictator, who was always there ever since you grew up, all of a sudden was asked to retire. How did you get to blogging, Takura?
Yeah, thank you, Christoph. I got to blogging as a means of accentuating freedom of expression in Zimbabwe and putting out alternative views on political developments in Zimbabwe, as well as on African events, political developments, and so on. So I've been at it for a while. And yes, we have a change of government in Zimbabwe. It doesn't mean things have gotten better. In fact, people debate whether it was a coup, not a coup, or whether the president resigned. But I'm a part-time blogger. I don't earn money from blogging. I write on political issues. I write on social issues. I also dabble in political economy as and when the opportunity arises. And also, significantly, I write on Pan-African issues or issues that affect the continent.
Thank you, Takura. Anne-Marie, you are from Cameroon. Cameroon is a country, as some of you might know, which has its own problems, which are linguistic problems. Or you can later elaborate on that. But you're living in Senegal, a relatively free country. What drove you to blogging?
I started blogging in November 2015. I never planned to be a blogger, actually. It's because of Aisha that I'm blogging now. When I met her, she's coordinating the network of African cyber activists, and I was invited to their first summit in November 2015. And I met her, and I met several bloggers and activists from all over Africa who were really working to change things for the better in their countries. And in my country, we are conditioned not to think about politics. So it was the first time for me to be around young people really active into political things. And seeing them made me realize that it was possible and that I could do that for my country too. And I had the advantage to be out of the country, so it was easier for me to talk. After that summit, I just created my blog, El Citoyen, meaning like She the Citizen. And today, it's not a baby blog anymore. It's a platform voicing the opinions of about 40 people across the continent.
Would the three of you say that, I mean, you are three voices of very different countries or differing countries on the continent, male, female, Anglophone, Francophone. Would you, if one can generalize it, say that it's an advantage that most of the bloggers, the political bloggers on the African continent, they don't need to make a living of it, or they don't have the intention to make a living of blogging because they have a breadwinning job and the blogging is a political outlet that they use? Maybe Takura?
It's not quite an advantage, because if we could blog all the time, we would. And if we could make an income from it, we would. So, because largely blogging is not yet popular to the extent that it would be in the global north, so it's harder to make a living off it. but also because the mainstream media is still more powerful than blogging, and in terms of adverts and so on, you cannot compete with that. The only advantage, and I must say this, is that there's an editorial independence to blogging without looking for specific revenue, because there are political blogs such as ours, and then there are entertainment blogs, which deal with fashion and music. And those tend to make money on their own, and those tend to be run on a full-time basis. But ours, the fact that we don't rely on somebody else to pay us to make an income means we have a bit more editorial independence.
Takuro, you were with us in Senegal during the events of the retirement of Robert Mugabe. And then you and another Zimbabwean colleague said that when you were blogging, because there was so much excitement on social media about the dictator having been forced to go, whereas you and your colleague, you were trying to calm people down and to analyze the situation. Was that a very lonely position you were in those events in Zimbabwe, when on social media I was sometimes thinking there might be revenge killings and
Blogging in general is a lonely
it's
a lonely exercise.
So it's very exceptional that Cast Media Africa succeeded to bring together almost 20 bloggers and for them to work together. But back to Zimbabwe.
We try when you blog, you try to put out what is not being put out by mainstream media. You look for different angles, and you look for you look at the long term. So if you look at Zimbabwe's situation or case where there was a forced resignation of a president by his colleagues in the military because they view themselves as one and the same thing, we try to put out the very reasonable assertion that this was an internal ruling party succession program. It was not a people's revolution in the strict sense of the term. And of course, we were told that you guys are going against the grain. But then as time has gone on, it has turned out to be exactly what we sort of analyzed and put out on our blogs. So yeah, it's blogging, particularly from an African angle, can be lonely, especially if you're trying to bring to the fore freedom of expression and other democratic values and blog based on facts.
Aisha, Takura has mentioned earlier on that the mainstream media or traditional media is still very powerful economically. Sometimes it seems that you social media activists, as you may call yourselves, or bloggers or political commentators, seem to be filling a vacuum or a void that is there. Can one say that about the Gambia as well?
The Gambia, I would say social media in general played a great role in raising the awareness of the people and making sure that people voted to get the president out and it wasn't a coup d'etat. And the new head of state, when he was being inaugurated, and because his whole campaign, actually, he did it on social media. People were like, because you have all these online radios that are Gambia-focused, but based outside, who will give the coalition of opposition parties the platform to put their message across. And then other people will take those audios and put it into WhatsApp audio and share it to amplify the message on the ground. Social media actually helped Gambians in the diaspora, because when the issue, the political impasse happened, some people, unfortunately in Africa, were saying that Gambians, the election actually was funded by Westerners. No international organization or Western country put a dime in those elections in December. The government decided that they were going to fund it, and the Gambians in the diaspora funded the coalition government. People gave $1, $5 to make sure, because they wanted change. And they asked their people on the ground, their family members and relatives, to go out, get a voter's card, and go out and vote peacefully. And that's what happened. And the president, the current president, often says that if it wasn't because of social media in general, be it blogs, Facebook, and all the WhatsApp, Viber, and all others, they wouldn't have won. because the whole media, mainstream media, was controlled by Jammeh. On the other hand, the private media, though there were many private radios in the Gambia, they only dealt with music and sports. And the newspapers who were independent, because of all the trouble they went through and the financial difficulties they were experiencing, chose to, most of the time, self-censor so that they would be able to survive in the environment. So there is a picture, unfortunately I didn't share here. It's during the president's inauguration, the new president, there was the hashtag Gambia has decided. And that hashtag brought a whole country together and the whole world supported us. And during the inauguration at the stadium, that was the biggest and most important image you could see. And when I see that image, I say the power of a hashtag, the power of social media. There are other ways, even though we have difficulties in terms of access to electricity, access to internet and phone, but we have ways of making sure that information goes and reaches the people they should reach.
Would you say that some of the events, for example, in the Gambia, would be a reminder of what happened during the Arab Spring?
Because the contexts are different, when it comes to the use of social media, I could say yes. But in the Gambia, there were never any public gathering where everywhere we'll go to protest because you know that your life was on the line. And each country has its own ways of dealing with its difficulties. I would say in terms of using social media to get what they wanted, I would say that. But I won't take the comparison further.
Anne-Marie, when we talk about the weakness of social of traditional media, do you, as a relatively young person in the field, have an explanation for that? Where does it come from? Is it a similar crisis like we have in the media and the traditional media in Europe, or is it that the media becomes boring? That
in my country, media are controlled by the government. Like, you cannot say what you want. We have this popular program on TV, a private channel, where they sometimes invite people to speak their mind. And sometimes when it goes far, when these people start saying things that are dangerous for them, at some point the host says, I know that tonight we will sleep in jail and we will be tortured and beaten, but it's okay, we will talk, you see. So the media, they are controlled by the government. And you were talking about the crisis in my country. The English.
When we talk about your country, it is Cameroon.
Yes, yes. The English-speaking part of the country, some of the people that are involved in the crisis want the English-speaking part of the country to become a country on its own. They want secession. And now it is forbidden for media, for newspapers, to use the word secession because the government doesn't want that part of the news to be covered. So I think in my country it's mainly because of the government. That the mainstream media is that weak.
Was there a decisive point in your career as a journalist or as a blogger where you thought, am I trying to fill a gap here that the traditional media left behind? Aisha?
For me, actually, it became, because like almost every family in the Gambia, my family personally suffered the dictatorship. So it became like a duty to myself, to my profession, and to make sure that everything that's happening in the Gambia during the Jammeh regime was out there for the world to see, for the world to hear. And what I was doing is I will make sure that every day I post or say something about what was happening in the Gambia. So that was a duty for me. When Jammeh left, when he lost the elections, people I met years ago from all over the world, even China, called me and said, now you can move on with your life. I never saw it like it was keeping me behind, because that's when I realized that I sacrificed so much and I lost so much. But it was a choice, and I was happy to do it. Because of the situation on the ground, the mainstream media was in a way forced to hide the information inside the story. So it won't be the headline, it won't be the introduction. You have to read the story, go further down and get the information. So what I'll do is I will read, pull out the information and highlight that. Mm-hmm. And there, because of the situation, I would say in a way, but I was still using their information. So I was trying to do out from outside what they could not do from inside.
To answer this question, I think that sometimes we feel like we have to talk about some things. Like in Cameroon, at some point we had confidential documents that were leaked on social media, like speeches from the president. Sorry, my English didn't get that good.
Presidential speeches.
Yes, presidential speeches that were leaked before the speech was broadcasted.
Okay.
And
Cameroonian WikiLeaks.
Yes. So we had a lot of confidential documents leaked on social media, and no one told these people that it was not good to do that. And I had to ask that Twitter bird in jail. I had to ask a lawyer to tell us if there was a law that condemned that action, and if it existed, we had to tell people that they could go to jail for that. I think when it comes to news or information, there is news that people should know, and there is things that people should know, and there are things that people need to know.
So you have more or less like a gatekeeper,
yes,
functional position that the traditional media
sometimes
had, and has. Takura, I wanted to ask you, I mean, Zimbabwe after independence in 1980 had a very lively literary scene, and also a very, shall I say, a very vivid journalistic scene. I mean, there was a lot of debate, and there, you know, many intellectuals had come back from exile or underground. The place, despite its political problems, was thriving intellectually. That has ended quite a few years ago. What does that do to the public? What does that do to the audience if they are not used to intellectual fodder anymore from their papers and from their university lectures? And are you, as bloggers, the only ones left behind?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I think what it does to the public is it makes them lose confidence in their right to receive and impart information that is of democratic value to them. But as bloggers, what we try and do is we try and put out quasi-analytical, quasi-informative information for them to consider. And the reason why we do that is probably because of two things. First of all, access to the internet and social media, which changes the speed of the news cycle, or if an event occurs and we're able to look at it with a relative amount of speed before the next day's paper comes out, people have some sort of background information which is analytical to that. And then secondly, because we really use blogging to put out alternative viewpoints from the media, which can be captured by perhaps political players, perhaps corporate players who might not be interested in objective journalism and reporting. So, but what it has done to the Zimbabwean public, and I think we could safely say for a greater part of Southern Africa, is that the lack of an intellectual or analytical tradition to journalism now, unlike, say, compared to here in Germany, has meant that people get shortchanged in terms of the right sort of information or analyzed information or objective journalism. And blogging, as well as even microblogging, can help fill that void. We can't take over the position and place of universities, colleges, and even mainstream media, but we can at least set an example, and that's one of the main reasons why we blog. Setting an example, trying to assist younger Africans, younger Zimbabweans to understand that they have a right to not only express themselves, but to express themselves on both serious and non-serious political or economic matters.
Which leads me to the next question, maybe Anne-Marie, you can reflect on that. I mean, the bloggers, like the bloggers on Africa blogging, they have a few hundred, maybe a few thousand followers and readers. It's not necessarily, but it depends. Maybe Aisha can also elaborate that on the dramatic events in the Gambia and Dakura and Zimbabwe. But who is your audience? Do you know anything about the people who are reading your blog? Male, female, young, old, educated, illiterate, well, not illiterate, but educated or very educated, wealthy or poor?
We can have some data on our readership. We have Google Analytics, and WordPress has something on audience. Mm-hmm. So I know that El Citoyen is read by men mostly.
El Citoyen is read by men.
Yes, and they are around 24 and 34. Years old, yes, they speak mostly French. They are not mostly Cameroonians, yeah. So we have these kind of data, yeah.
So, but you cannot really paint yourself the ideal reader or the typical reader of your blog. Or whom do you think about when you blog?
No one, because when I write, I'm most of the time angry, so I don't think of anyone, just only my anger.
All right.
But I know that, as I told you, we have some data. Like, I know that they use mostly their smartphones. They love news and sports. I don't know why, because I don't talk about sports. Between 24 and 34, as I told you, Cameroonian from the diaspora and Senegalese people. So we have that kind of data here.
Aisha, how was that in the Gambia? I mean, I could imagine that during the peak of events around the flight of Yahya Jammeh, you were very, very, you had many, many clicks.
Yes, and when it comes to reaching a higher, more diverse audience regarding the Gambia, I go to Facebook because I know my grandfather's cousin is there, like from the oldest to the youngest. I write there on Facebook. But when I know that this is for the international community, I go to Twitter because I know that's where Most of them follow me. Actually, the target audience follow me, and I know that I have that interaction with them on Twitter. So that's how I divide my my audience. Most people actually now. I was telling Anne-Marie that we're having more and more Gambians join Twitter because some of them think Twitter is elitist. That the Gambians that are on Twitter are elitist in a way. There's too much noise on Facebook and all the abuses that come with social media, yeah. It's there. So to distance myself sometimes from that, I just focus on Twitter because I know that the people I talk to, well, they still attack me, but it won't be as violent and as personal as on Facebook. And if you want to reach more people, the Gambian audience, it's Facebook. And that was what was used during the crisis until Jammeh left. And one thing I discovered actually is during that period is there were there was an information overflow. And the Jammeh side or people who supported or saw Jammeh as a kind of a Pan-Africanist were trying to control the narrative. And me and others, actually what our duty was, not to take side, take a civil society standpoint, but making sure that any information that's not right and that we see, we will correct it. So maybe you would ask the question later, but because of that, some people saw us as opposition. While that was not, we were not, I'm non-partisan. The people I mostly collaborate with are non-partisan. The most important thing was people voted, their vote should be respected. And it was a push and pull in terms of who is going to control the narrative, not only locally, but internationally.
Have you come across a situation where you are writing against the powers that be, or you're writing against injustices, for example, and then a particular group is in power after an election, and they think that you are with them, but you remain critical, and they don't like that?
I think that's the story of my life with almost every African country I deal with, because I get criticism from different African countries because I cover a lot of issues. Yeah, it happens. I think that's the main misunderstanding, actually. Like Takura said, blogging is a lonely thing. And I think because we decided that this is what we want to do, we want to share the knowledge we have or go interview others and share what they know to enlighten people. So when you are doing that, while there's, for example, a dictator in power, people will think that you are partisan. And when that changes, the people who are in power will think that you will continue the sugarcoating. When it's not that, things change, because the most important thing is general good. What's the interest of the people? That's what my interest is. And whatever I do, I have my life. I could have decided that, you know what, I mean, I could live my life and be at peace and not be stressed by anything. But I've decided to be a committed citizen, an engaged citizen. So I sacrifice that time for the benefit of the general good. Backlashes, yes. In private, in public, yes. And people, like for instance in Gambia, I am no longer writing as I used to on the Gambia because there's too much noise. It's good. We fought for freedom of expression and everyone is writing. I'm really happy. People who would have never dared write a sentence about the head of state now write paragraphs. So that's a positive thing. But when people meet you, they'll say, we no longer hear you. Why are you not talking? I tell them, I talk when I have to talk. And it's not because there's something going on that I should always put that out. You don't know, maybe, because I have grown as an individual, maybe I'm using other channels to reach out to these people. And when I know that it's not working, I talk. Or when I know that there is no use me going to talk to them behind closed doors, I put it out there because that's my independence.
So you basically reject the pressure that derives from social media, that you always have to be present and you always have to say something about...
Yes, everything. Because it's not because you are on social media. I'm not doing that to be paid. Like, I don't earn anything from that. I'm using my time, my resources. It's because I want to. So people will want you to, because they know that when you talk, people listen to you, so they would want you to be talking about all the things going wrong. But they're not thinking about your well-being as a person. You can't be talking about everything every time. You have to be selective. You have to be strategic. One at a time. One issue at a time.
Takura, when Mugabe was when Mugabe was withdrawing, I think you and your colleague Blessing Vava you also got comments like from people who said, well, why are you so critical about the new people in power? Can't you just be happy that the situation is going to change now and so on? What energy does it take, or where do you gather the strength to stand your position against all the people celebrating on the streets who don't agree with you?
I think it's about a value system, what you believe in. I believe in freedom of expression, access to information. I believe in interrogating what's happening in society. And I generally blog once a week, towards the end of the week. I try and pick up key developments on the African continent, or if I'm at Republica, I will definitely blog about it, which I've already done, in order to share information. And the main reason is because of the value system. So when somebody says, you wrote a lot of nonsense, or why are you undermining the new establishment? Fair enough, I'll defend their right to say that to me, because they have a right to express it, as long as they don't beat me up. But at the same time, and I would agree with Aisha, you also have to be selective. There's some issues that you don't have to pick on, because essentially either they are abstract, unimportant, or they don't bring a new dimension to public access to information or democratic knowledge of value. So it's not a big deal to be attacked online, to be trolled. It happens a lot. For me personally, it doesn't affect me emotionally. I'm used to it. In fact, I'm actually happy when people start attacking me on social media, because it basically means somebody's reading it. if they don't, or if they overpraise me, it means I've got trolls that are working on my behalf. But anyway, I don't have those. So the essential point is about your value system, particularly democratic value system, where you want to accentuate freedom of expression and access to information, which we generally call ATI. I know that here it's taken as a given in Europe, but for us, and for me personally, it's really about setting that example, regardless of the disparaging comments and remarks.
And Marie, the value system that both Aisha and Takura were talking about is a good thing to have, but isn't there a danger, even in countries like Cameroon and Senegal, that there are bloggers around and social media activists who don't have such kind of a value system, and that's when it gets dangerous?
I think it all depends on what you're looking for and why you do what you do. As he said, when you believe in something, you do it not for other people. Do it for yourself. I think I cannot criticize negatively those who do not have values, because they know why they do what they do. But for me, I don't do it to be. I don't need an ovation. That's the word, right?
Mm.
Yes. I'm just doing it for people to know the truth, and for them to be able to forge their own opinion.
In Europe, there was a time, or there still is a time, I think, when blogging has a certain image. In blogs, you find a lot of conspiracy theories. You find people who follow their hobbies, you know. They present their whiskey collection or their poodles. So there's a blogging doesn't have a super reputation. How is that in your respective environments?
Right now in Cameroon, bloggers are terrorists, because that's the word they used in parliament. We are terrorists. So they are working on new laws for to make us shut up. So, and bloggers are considered, like, for the government, we are terrorists, and for the people, we are in the opposition. Like, we have to be against the government all the time. If we are not against the government, then we are against them, we are against the people. So it's really not easy to it's not a comfortable situation to always have to it's difficult actually.
And I'm sure the Zimbabwean government doesn't give innovative bloggers funding.
Especially on human rights and political opinion, they don't support. They support, or they're beginning to support, bloggers on entrepreneurship, fashion, and music, and sports. Mainly because
the sons of Robert Mugabe, they developed this T-shirt collection, which they are now
And it's the one thing that we, at least from a Zimbabwean perspective, we're perpetually conscious of, that there's always a desire by African governments to crowd us out.
Yes.
To crowd out activists that deal with human rights, freedom of expression issues, and say, but we are progressive already. And this is the case in Tanzania, where the Tanzanian government is saying bloggers must pay, I think, the equivalent of $500 to register, an initial application fee and a registration fee every year. That will be $400 plus $500, so $900 to be a blogger, just to have what you're seeing on the screen there. And one of the things that one of the reasons that is done is not because they will not accept other bloggers on fashion entertainment, but to ensure that they stifle the critical content creators or the critical bloggers and stifle, in the process, free expression.
In Uganda, there are plans to set up a fee for each and every post that you do on social media. Do you see a danger that other African governments might try to copy this kind of plan?
There's one thing that African governments are good at is copycatting. Laws that are usually bad. This is not a law, but with internet shutdown, seeing it has become the norm on the continent. When it comes to laws,
internet shutdown usually happens during elections or political upheaval.
Yes, during elections, political protests, or when they want to, for instance, there was an exam last year, I think it was last year, in Ethiopia and Algeria, they decided that they would shut down the internet for a number of days so that students could do the exams without cheating. So now any excuse is good to just shut down the internet, not thinking of, or shut down social media actually, not thinking of the repercussions that has on people's life and the economy. There was Internet Without Borders recently stated that, quoting a report, that I think in DRC, actually the telecom operators will lose $1.5 million for a three-day shutdown. So that's a lot of money. Coming back to laws, for instance, in the Gambia, there's, I think it was in 2013, and we call it the internet law. What the law said, that you don't have the right to criticize a public official, including the president. You risk up to between 3 and 5 years jail, and there was an exorbitant amount of fine that you had to pay just for posting something online, be it on a blog, be it on a website or social media. They didn't care. So now you have all these countries having all so-called social media law. Usually they will take a section from here, a section from the other country, and try to adjust it, put some salt and, you know, on the local context, and just to find a way of silencing dissent. What we are seeing is they don't know how to deal with internet. So the best way for them is do what they do offline. That's arresting people, surveillance. So they repeat the same thing online. And this is becoming a trend. And for a blogger to pay to register $500, where is that, if you are a political blogger, where are you going to get that money from? You know, it's just a way of silencing dissent, and that's a violation of a citizen's basic right, because internet, access to internet, access to information, those are rights, and as any other rights. So why would you want to choose for your citizen, while as a government, your role is to protect your citizen, to provide basic services, and to respect that not every other, every single citizen will have to love you, be praised, singing you. That's the difficulty we have in most African countries.
Kura?
Yeah, and it's a very important point that Aisha is making. And as is happening here in the global north, the shutdowns are not just government decisions, but not that the shutdowns are happening here, but there's a complicity between the telecommunications companies or the internet service providers and African governments that decide to shut down, to the extent that the censorship is not simply a government censorship. And I know that here at Republica we've been discussing Cambridge Analytica and the collusion with parties and elections and so on, or the manipulation of processes. It's the same thing in Africa, or at least in the global south. You've got these mega monopoly internet service providers, telecommunications companies, who then work in collusion with government to say, okay, look, we're not going to allow these bloggers to have that reach. We're not going to do such and such so that these freedom of expression is extended. But we really want to make a profit. So we'll listen to what you as a government want us to do, and then we're not, so that you don't have to shut down the internet. So if you want us to censor Anne-Marie or Aisha, it's not a problem. We'll look at them and we'll track them and so on. But just don't shut us down, because we'll lose a lot of money. And that affects freedom of expression in general. So we, in Africa, we're also trying to think about how do we bring private corporations to account around internet freedom, right to privacy, and the accentuation of freedom of expression.
How far have you come with that in Zimbabwe, for example?
Well, in Zimbabwe, the problem is that the government and telecommunications companies are very close. So we're trying to write about it, we're trying to work with media freedom activists to deal with the situation. But I'm pretty sure this requires more of an African Union approach, a regional approach, because some of these telecommunications companies, particularly fiber optic companies, they transcend borders from East Africa to the South, and I think from Southern West Africa to Northwest Africa, because fiber optic is, as you know, it transcends borders. So we really need a continental approach to dealing with this problem.
Anne-Marie, you live in a particular situation because you are Cameroonian. You blog, amongst other things, about events in Cameroon, but you are living abroad. You are living in Senegal. Does the fact that you live outside your home country give you a certain protection, or do you have unpleasant experiences when you visit home?
Truth is, I think that if I was living in my country, I would have never been a political blogger. To tell the truth, I would have never done that because...
Out of fear?
Yes. Yes. Living out of the country, it's really a protection for me. And having my website, let's say, out of the country, is also an opportunity for young people from my country, living in the country, to make their voice heard. Because I remember that when I created that blog, I lost so many friends because they were like, you are doing something so dangerous, I cannot be associated to you. I don't want to be your friend anymore, because what you're doing is too dangerous for me to be around that. And after a year, the same people came back to me saying, I have something to say, can I write something and you post it? So it's a protection for me, but it's also a way for them to be able to speak their mind. Yeah.
I wanted to ask the audience if you have any questions before we come to our final conclusion about the future of blogging. I'm sure we have a microphone somewhere, and if there's anyone who wants to raise his or her hand, Mrs. Averbeck.
Actually, thank you very much. It's quite interesting to hear what you are doing. My question is, as I have lived in Zimbabwe, how the new government, the Mnangagwa government, whether they've changed something? Do you experience anything different to the time of Mugabe. Then we are expecting elections there at the second half of this year. So I remember last time, 2013, certain people, we did not know the identity of the people, influenced public opinions. And I wonder how it's happening at the moment. Do you also have bloggers sort of who are spreading news? Maybe you can assume that they are more sort of on the side of ZANU-PF, trying to support the ruling party. So maybe if you can just highlight a little bit how's the situation at the moment. And I remember also that, maybe an additional question, that some people were arrested some years ago when the then government was fearing that something like the Arab Spring could happen. Remember, I think they were posting on Facebook certain issues, and they were arrested just because they did this post on Facebook. So something like that, can that still happen in Zimbabwe, or do you think it's likely?
Yeah, thank you for the questions. And I'll give you some quick replies. The situation is that the new government, which came through what is called a coup, but not a coup, is basically trying to prove itself to gain international legitimacy and acceptance. So it's not arresting people, as Mugabe would have done. It's giving a veneer of progress, and it's definitely opening up the country for business. So essentially, it's really changing things at a very elite level, and in order to satisfy both regional, continental, and international community requirements. On the second question concerning, so the change hasn't been really felt on the ground. The economy is still bad, and the government can still arrest you. So it's sort of like a benevolent situation. The government feels sorry for us, but if it wants to arrest us, it can. The second question concerning elections and bloggers influencing opinion. Yeah, definitely. There's competition on social media in Zimbabwe. Trolls countering trolls. People are trying to influence young people who are on Facebook in particular and on WhatsApp to support their candidates over the other. So the ruling party has its own people that are playing around with social media. The opposition has some people, but I don't think they're as well resourced as a ruling party. And so we've already started the election campaign, and the likelihood of the social media's role escalating between the political parties is very high. The third question or point around what has happened to those that used to post, and will it happen again? Yes, there was a period where social media was critical in providing a platform for dissent in Zimbabwe. That was in 2016. But social media tends to have a peak around a specific time period. So they were arrested, and then some of the people then decided they didn't want to do the hashtag situation anymore or campaigns anymore. And then they also decided that they would campaign largely from a religious angle. But the new government really doesn't care about them anymore. I don't think anyone is still on remand or going to court. I think they were acquitted. I don't think they will be arrested for doing the same thing in the short term, and not least before elections, because the government really wants to look good.
Thank you, Takura. We have time for one last question.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this inspiring talk. My question is the following. I mean, a lot of Africans actually trust foreign media much more than their national media. And wouldn't you think that if bloggers could have a platform on, let's say, with Jeune Afrique or the BBC or so, that you would have a far much more reach than you have now? And also because Africans normally are also very interested in what's happening next door in other countries. Couldn't be there something which would give you more reach? I think that's basically what I'm asking for.
Well, there is Mondo blogging, for example, and there's Africa blogging, but maybe you guys can give a very brief answer to that.
First of all, I will say that we don't trust Jeune Afrique. We don't. And the problem with having a platform with these media is censorship, to tell the truth. They don't let people say what they want to say. Mondo Blog, for example, sometimes remove some sentences in articles or add some things. I think the reason why I am with CAS and Africa Blogging is because they don't do that. I can say what I want to say. They will not censor me. And the second thing is, Takura was talking about editorial line, right? When you write on this type of platforms owned by media, like they kind of control what you have to say, what you want to say. No, not what you want, because what you want to say, you cannot say it. They control what you say. And it's, even if you can reach more people, you are not really sharing what you want to share. So it's not that useful to me.
Aisha, you want to add on it?
Yeah, I'll just echo Anne-Marie's. Yeah, it's true that most Africans rely on foreign media to have information on what's happening next door. But the problem is, and I think it's mostly with all mainstream media, is the independence we have as bloggers is, they don't necessarily have that because of the editorial lines, and that you see it from international media to local media. One thing, though, is that the only place where, because we don't have the resources to, like, amplify like mainstream media. If we had the resources, we could do that. And one of the best way to reach Africans is through community radios. For instance, when I travel around and I have the opportunity to talk about human rights, access to information, I do it, but it's not every time. And just to add to that, as Anne-Marie said, I am coordinating projects of the League of African Bloggers and Cyber Activists for Democracy, and we are going to start a program with West African Radio, where we will be giving tips on to people on how to use securely use the internet, how to avoid censorship, how to use VPN and things like that. And that is a platform that we want to use to continue actually sharing about political analysis and other things. So radio, if we had a radio, that would be great. But for now, we don't.
Thanks very much, Aisha. We have tried in this past hour to give you a glimpse or an insight into the diversity of blogging, into the challenges of blogging, by having these three very known bloggers from The Gambia, from Zimbabwe, and from Cameroon / Senegal. And I think when we talk about digital South, we should also think, of course, about business opportunities that lie in digital development in sub-Saharan Africa, but also about the political voices, the commenting voices, like these three brave bloggers from their respective countries. We have tried to show the diversity of this continent, and I can only strongly recommend, if you are interested in the topic, go to the website Africa Blogging. You can also go to the website of CAS Media Africa. There's always a top of the blogs that we publish on a rather regular basis, and you see the blogs of these three participants on the website Africa Blogging, where they, as they have said, can express what they think and what debates they reflect in their respective countries. Thank you very much for your attendance, and thank you very much to the three of you for coming this far to discuss with us tonight. Thank you.